Well, brothers, welcome to day three of our little Sinfonia meetings. I'm pleased to see some familiar faces from the last couple of days here. Tonight we do have three more talks lined up, and our first talk of the night is going to be by Brother Eric Jusqu. Please allow me to introduce Brother Jusqu. He was initiated into the Iota Omicron chapter of Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia on December 2nd, 2010 at Bowling Green State University in Bowling Green, Ohio. As a collegiate member, Eric served in several roles, including historian, fraternity education officer, and president. After graduating in 2015 with a Bachelor of Liberal Studies degree, Eric ultimately found himself working at Town Hall 2, a behavior health counseling agency, where Eric worked as a billing specialist for 2 years before going back to school. Eric is working toward his master's in college student personnel from BGSU and is set to graduate this spring. During his master's, Eric has worked as a graduate hall director, in addition to having volunteer stints with fraternity and sorority life as a new member coach and with the esports program as an Overwatch coach. Eric is preparing to do job searching across the country and hopes to find a role that will allow him to help as many students be successful, whatever that ends up looking like. The title of his talk is Higher Education: Where We've Been, Where We Are, and Where We're Going. Brothers, please help me to welcome Brother Eric Jusqu.
Thank you. I'm gonna go ahead and check the screen. Cool. Yeah, so welcome. I will preface it first. I am using two screens, so if I ever look over here, it's because I'm looking at Zoom. So just as a fair warning on that. But otherwise, yeah, welcome to my presentation. This is adapted from something that we did in one of the Friday with Fridays. But I've kind of specified it more specifically towards some actionable stuff that collegiate members could do now, although I don't. And I will say if anything pops in the chat that I need to hear, I don't know that I can actually read it. Yeah, I can. There it is.
Eric, I'll also be here to help communicate with the chat so that you don't necessarily have to have it open while you're presenting.
I was going to say, worst case, you can always just unmute and talk. I'm way okay with that. So, higher education, where we've been, where we are, where we're going. I'm going to give a little bit of a preemptive, almost warning. I don't like warning, but it's kind of just a heads up, I guess, that a lot of our conversation is going to be around social justice and social justice initiatives. So, just a heads up that that's what we're going to be talking about. So, it might get a little deep. So, be prepared for that. I did want to set some ground rules though before we get into it, because I know these conversations can get a little bit tricky. I don't know why I put patient participation. I don't know what patient means there. But because we're talking about social justice, it's really good to have participation. And I think, oh, that's what it was. The patient was being patient if other people were sharing, and kind of focusing on listening first, talking second. I think that's a good ground rule for us to have. I think this is also a space for learning. Everybody's going to come into this setting with different levels of knowledge and different backgrounds. So some people might be more knowledgeable on certain topics. So be patient with those folks and recognize that this is a space for learning. So if somebody does say something improperly, we'll correct it, but don't hold that against them because this is a space for learning. Feel free to ask questions, but I want to include a no tokenization. So if you have questions of an identity that somebody does hold and you want to ask that, feel free, but try not to tokenize it and be like, what is the experience like of that identity? No, ask them what their experience is like. And then the last one is kind of a sort of the Vegas rule, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas, but with an addendum of what's said here stays here, but what's learned here leaves here. So if somebody's sharing a story of their own, don't go sharing their story with other people, but share the things you've learned. Cool. That said, I want to hop into where we've been. And I'm going to take this all the way back to the beginning, to beginning of higher education. And I want to see if anybody knows the significance of this before I get into this, other than Dave Friday, because Dave was there when this was brought up before. But does anybody know the significance of that date, October 28th, 1636?
That sounds an awful lot like Harvard.
It is. It is the founding of Harvard, which was the first institution of higher education in the United States of America. It marks the beginning of it all. Initially, schools were started under this Oxbridge model, which is founded over, or which is kind of inspired by, if you'll be so surprised, schools like Oxford and Cambridge over in the UK, focused on very separated from society, teaching in the classics, teaching things like Latin, law, very focused in, at the time, teaching young men to become either like lawyers or clergy. That was the purpose of it. And I might have spoiled that a little bit with this question here of what was studying and who got to study. But it was specifically white men with money who got to then study to become a lawyer or a religious person. We kind of existed in that era for a while. You saw a lot of the Ivy League institutions founded, places like Washington and Jefferson were founded, and it was very classical education based. Then in 1862, and again in 1892, we saw the Morrill Act, which brought in the land grant universities. These are all of the, a lot of the research institutions that you now see today, Ohio State, Michigan State, a lot of your A&M colleges are all kind of in that era. And they were founded in more of a Germanic model that was very research oriented. Things like Johns Hopkins is one that we talked about in my program, where you see a lot of resources focused around research and sciences. And so it kind of brought about a shift in that education where you saw more vocational type education. You saw more, I don't want to say useful because that sounds bad towards the classics, but more easily applicable things towards doing a tangible job. Along with this, with these moral acts, came the founding of a lot of the historical Black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, because states had to provide schooling for both white people and for Black people. But there was no, at the time, the dates back to Plessy v. Ferguson, that Supreme Court case, saying that separate but equal is equal. And so that's where we really started to see separate schools developed for white people and Black people. Obviously now today, a lot of those schools that were founded, Howard University is perhaps the most prominent one that comes to mind. They've now become historically Black colleges and universities. That's a whole sort of, I don't want to say genre, but categorization of colleges and universities. Obviously, you all can probably guess, but I threw in October 6, 1898. What happened then? Go for it, Dave.
Something Founders Day.
Yes, obviously. Just a fun little thing to put in there, just to show you kind of where Find Me Up was found on the timeline. And knowing that it was founded at a place like New England Conservatory, it was very much white dominated at that time. That's not to say that there weren't any African-Americans studying at the New England Conservatory. There may have been, but it was very, very rare to see people of color at institutions in general, let alone at an institution that wasn't specifically for African-Americans. So we kind of existed in this range for a while, saw some time where more women were starting to be admitted into college. Fast forward to about the 1960s, and we see the civil rights era, which was where we started to see a lot of the social justice initiatives starting. We saw things like, I can't remember the names of them now. We saw Black students being admitted into white schools, and it was this idea of integration. And we saw the overturning of Plessy v. Ferguson to say that separate but equal is not equal. And so we really started to see a lot more all people being in institutions. This then led into a couple of different eras that I want to touch on briefly before we get into the next section of this, which is the era of consumerism and the era of professionalism. Era of consumerism was about 1970s to like late 1990s, early 2000s or so. And it was really when college students began demanding certain things for their education. They wanted certain things, they wanted a certain standard of life in order to go to places. And that's where you really started to see facilities being upgraded. You started to see better residence halls. You started to see pools. You started to see rock climbing walls, more programming, more student organizations. With that came the need for more staff to oversee a lot of that. Hence where we got into the era of professionalism and where somebody like me is now working in the field as a hall director, as somebody who, you know, what is it, 50 years ago might not have, this position might not have existed. And if it did, it would have been done by either a faculty member or a faculty member's spouse. With that came about a lot of new demands for education. You started to see programs like mine in higher education student affairs, started to see programs focused on teaching professionals to be in this field. I bring all of that up to mostly to make the point of higher education's costs has increased. And it's, I say, a direct result of those two eras. The era of consumerism brought about better things, which cost more money. And that money has to be covered from somewhere. And a lot of that cost has been put onto students. Similarly with the era of professionalism, there are more staff members working at institutions that also need to be paid. And all of those things have kind of brought about increased costs. And so a lot of the question, and I think this is where we can really start to connect some to 5U Alpha, is how do we make those costs worth it, the students that are there? How do we make it worth the money being spent? And that's just something maybe to keep in the back of your mind throughout the rest of this conversation and throughout the rest of the year, decade, et cetera, is whenever we're working in higher education, how do we make it worth the money? That was a really, really quick overview of some of the most important parts through what's basically 15 hours of like a grad school level class. Were there any questions or any general thoughts that people wanted to ask real quick?
I was actually just about to type this into the chat, but it makes me wonder how many things there are on campus that students' tuition dollars paid for that they have access to, that they have literally no idea that they have access to it.
Yeah, perhaps honestly, the most frequent thing you see that with is that we have two things here at BG. One is student legal services, the other is student counseling center. There are dollars that come out of student fees. They are both, actually the counseling center is not, but the legal services is an opt-in or technically opt-out, but it is an optional fee that a lot of times students don't know. So sometimes students might have a legal issue, whether it's something as simple as a speeding ticket or something as complex as a possession under the age or possession of legal drug or something like that. And a lot of times students won't know that they have access to a lawyer who's specifically there to help them at no extra cost to them as a student. Similarly with counseling center, a lot of students don't realize that, and it depends on the school, but at least at BG, the counseling center is free for them to use. There is no cost. The counseling center is not going to bill students insurance, so they don't have to worry about parents seeing it on an insurance and wondering what's going on. So there is definitely services like that that students just aren't aware of. So sometimes it's even educating on these are the things that are available to the student. So, but great point. Thank you for bringing that up. So yeah, that's kind of where we've been. Obviously that is, it's very hard to sum up, what is it? Math, what, 340 some odd years, if not more, almost 400 years, math got there, of higher education in 15 minutes. But if I had to do it, those are the things that I pull out as the most important parts. So, cool. Where we are, what's going on right now? And I know anybody who is currently in higher education in some setting can really understand a lot of this. I know like Brother Friday is, some of you, I believe, are collegiate members currently. So obviously COVID-19 is a big thing, still is. There's a lot of schools, I think Harvard, second time it's been brought up, but Harvard just announced that they were going virtual for the first couple of weeks of next semester. And a lot of schools are starting to do that. I don't know if the Ohio schools are gonna do that, but a lot of them are. And it's been a thing. We're not gonna talk too much about COVID here unless y'all want to. We certainly can, but I think everybody's a little bit COVIDed out, but it does still have some merit in our conversations. So if it does need to come up and somebody wants to bring it up, please feel free. Next thing is social justice. And I think this is a big one. There have been a lot of initiatives around social justice, even before the murder of George Floyd. There were so many social justice issues dating back to when I was an undergrad and before that are still not really resolved. And this is with regards to race, with regards to sexuality, with regards to gender identity, regards to gender itself. There's so much to do in that area that there's a lot of students that are feeling one of two things. They're either feeling not supported in what they're doing, which then makes them wonder why they're in this community. So it comes back to how do we make it worth their money? Or they're feeling burnt out. There's a lot of students who, after advocating for themselves for so long, they're burnt out from doing it and they need somebody else to help with that process. Decreased enrollment. This is kind of a twofer. We're starting to have less people of college age due to just less children. It's just a generational difference from 90s to the 2010s. But also less people going to college. Combination of COVID and more of a focus on vocational work and it being okay to go be a welder or go be a truck driver, which I am fully in support of. And as somebody who is in a collegiate role, sometimes I will tell students like, is this where you want to be? Is this where you should be? And that answer sometimes is no, and that's okay. Police brutality I have on here still, that kind of connects in with social justice in some elements, but I separated them for the purpose of that because I think there's a lot of different opinions around a lot of these. And you know, it's something that is very prevalent on college campuses today, and it's a conversation that's being had. I had conversations with some of my staff that I worked with last year that they wanted to bring in a police officer to do a presentation. And I said, let's not, because that would trigger some people, because there are people who are very hesitant about police and who are nervous around them. And it's certainly impacting higher education. With that said, I want to see if anybody had anything else as far as a where we are, or if there were any current questions or anything.
Feel free to unmute or feel free to use the chat.
Yeah. Okay, cool. So we're going to pop into what I want the bulk of our presentation to be. So that's why I've kind of maybe rushed through those first bits. But talking about all that stuff is cool. But I want to talk about what are we going to actually do with this information. Some of these aren't as relevant to our conversation because I just kind of edited the PowerPoint from my Friday with Friday presentation. The ones that I really want to focus on, question-wise, any hardships specific to 5U Alpha and what can, CPRs, but everyone, do to help combat these hardships? And then what can, again, CPRs or everyone do for social justice? And whether in your time with in your college community or your professional career. So I think there's a couple of big takeaways that I want everybody to take from today. Those being that it is everyone's, social justice is everyone's work. There is nobody who is exempt from doing from working towards it. And that as good as FAMU Alpha typically is with regards to social justice and with regards to making the college experience worth it, there are still improvements there. So that's what I really want to focus on for our last part of this session. And I want this to be very discussion based. So if you need to take some time to think on it, cool. But that's where I'd like to go next.
So I'll contribute something. Very obviously, FAMU Alpha has been working on itself for the last 2.5 years or so. The declaration of the national emergency, if we're being honest, the slight breakdown in the province structure, it's very difficult to be a collegiate province representative if your province is not feeling very much like a province. Currently, out of our 38 provinces, I believe only 15 of them have governors, and only governors can hold workshops, and only at the workshop can a CPR be elected. And therefore, we would have at most 15 CPRs that are actually recognized by the national organization. So whether they have been duly elected or unduly elected, I still see value in the role of the CPR as somebody to help unify brothers within their area and join our collegiate brothers together. Yeah. I think that having them go on chapter visits and visit lots of different and diverse chapters is really important to the pursuit of education in terms of social justice, to understand what different brothers experience at different institutions, and then can pass that message along to anybody that they can interact with.
Well, I think you touched on a really great point in having CPRs being able to do chapter visits. Because I remember when all of this stuff was happening, I was working a little bit with Youngstown chapter at the time, which as Brother Alexson mentioned, we met at their initiation 1 year. And I saw the impacts very, very significantly of what it looks like for a chapter to not have any guidance, any support, because there just wasn't, it wasn't there for that chapter. And you know, I can imagine other chapters being in a difficult situation because there just isn't aid to give them right now. And I remember sitting in a conversation with them where one of the members had some issues with some of the ways the chapter was communicating in regards to some social justice initiatives. And the only support that they had there was me, because they didn't have a connection to anything. Now, to be fair, province three, I believe they're in, they were one of the provinces that didn't have their province governor removed. But the point still stands, there's no support from nationals in that moment. And everything was so crazy that the collegiate experience was being hindered. And I think that's what's made me most sad about it throughout, is I see folks going through their collegiate time and not having the same resources that I did to make my experience what it was. I think I rambled a little bit there, but no, I appreciate that point definitely. Anybody want to expand on that, or even if we change the topic?
Yeah, Brian. Well, one thing I'd like to point out is right now for the provinces that don't have an official CPR or any type of leadership beyond the local and hopefully the faculty advisor, there is nothing stopping an active collegiate member from going to another chapter and saying, hey, how y'all doing? Aside from, well, COVID safety, of course, but in province 33, it's a known fact that nobody goes anywhere. Nobody goes to another chapter unless they have to. Mm. And I know that's the case across the planet, because the hardest step for anybody on a trip to do something that could end up being fun but is actually not fun in the beginning is that first step, because you have to stand up off the couch, guys. Not y'all, but anybody else that listens. That first step, the standing up, is the hardest part. And I've been trying to get the guys here to do that. I've got one or two that will. But for anyone that listens later, there's nothing stopping you from going to another chapter and seeing their ritual, as long as you're doing it safely and correctly. And there's nothing to keep you from calling up the president of the chapter 2 hours away that you've not heard from in a while and don't know if they're still alive, going, hey, how's it going? Just wanting to check in. Because the province governors can't, in some cases, because of they've been told not to by somebody who's in authority, allegedly, or they're under a cease and desist, or they don't want to get under a cease and desist. They're trying to protect themselves from any potential outlay from somebody higher up in the fraternity. And it's sad to say it, but I respect that, because, you know, it's just difficult.
Brother Angel, to respond to the point that you're making, you are 100% correct. There is absolutely nothing stopping brothers from going to visit other chapters other than, you know, COVID safety protocols as they are in their current state. However, the beauty of the role of the CPR is the ability for them to make a report on it and to be reimbursed for their time and their gas money for their travels. It's sort of like a built-in, the fraternity just automatically approves of a CPR going to a chapter to do a visit.
Well, that's part of the job of a CPR.
Right.
And, absolutely.
And the responsibility of the national organization is to come back on the other half of that job and say, you fulfilled your duties, we're going to fulfill ours.
Indeed.
That has not happened. And that's as far as I need to go on that, on this type of call. But if you find an alumni in the area that says, hey, let's go, hit the alumni up and not necessarily frighten the other chapter with the old man in the suit, but frighten the chapter with the old man in the suit.
Absolutely. We have a couple contributions from the chat.
Yeah.
Brother Alexson says, as a current CPR in Province 39, I've attended at least three initiations, but some had to be asked consistently if they needed assistance. Some chapters need to get out of their shell and realize the potential of CPRs. Absolutely. Brother Hoffman says, I loved the term geographically blessed. Really does have an impact on that cross-chapter interaction. In my experience, it takes at least one brother with a vehicle who has the will and desire to travel. Keith, oh my gosh, yes. Province 2 is very geographically blessed.
Even as somebody who spent his time in the southern tip of Province 2, it was never too bad to go see other chapters. So, yeah. And that was, I don't mean to keep bringing up Youngstown, but that's a great point to bring up is, when we think about connection to other chapters, the closest chapter to Youngstown, at least at the time, I don't remember what's happening right now with Province 3, but is the chapter, I think, Edinburgh. I forget exactly the name of the college there, but it's the one that Brother Alexson, I believe, is from. And they're in a completely different province. The rest of the province that Youngstown is in is all in the southern part of the state of Ohio, which is at least 2 hours away, because it's Ohio State, Capital, Muskingum. Those are the closest other chapters to Youngstown, which is a little bit problematic that a chapter can have to go over 2 hours away to get any sort of assistance or support. So, And yeah, I agree with that, is that you don't have to stay in your own province. And then it makes there's a lot of debate to be had about, you know, which chapters should be in which province in some cases. But I think it's a testament to that of needing to maybe think about how we can help chapters who don't have as much resources. I think I forget what province it is, but the Idaho province, that I believe their province is just their chapter because there's nobody else there. And so how can we help situations like that? How can we provide support? How can we make their time and their money that they're spending worth it? You know, how can we make their dues worth it? There's a lot that can go into that conversation. And I apologize that I'm not really answering any of these questions that I'm putting out right now. I'm kind of just posing them and letting you all turn them into what you will. But I do think that a little bit of brainstorming can go a long way on these. And I'm gonna maybe go on a little bit of a rant here, but before I do, if at any point any of you want to pop in and say something, just unmute and start talking, and that's fine by me. But when I think to my time as a collegiate member, our dues weren't that bad. I don't think that's, you know, I think that's a standard across Fighting Alpha typically, is that dues aren't too bad. I think when I first joined, we were at about 140 a semester total, and that counts national dues and province dues. We eventually went up to about 180 a semester, which was still not too bad. And when you compare them to other fraternities and sororities, definitely not that bad. But I found myself having to answer to my brothers about, why are we paying this money? What are we getting out of this? And even when I'm talking to people who aren't a part of the fraternity in regards to recruitment, why should I pay money when I'm already going to be hanging out with these people? And it really created that conversation of what are people getting out of that money? And I think it's a fun thing that we can brainstorm a little bit together on, of what are collegiate members getting out of this experience. Sorry, I got caught off because I was reading the chat. Yeah, right. I apologize. I just went on, my brain got off topic. Sorry. Does anybody want to maybe talk for a little bit on that idea of how do we make the money worth the while, if that makes sense?
Are you talking specifically to the fraternity or to the college experience in general?
Or both, kind of whatever you're thinking.
Okay. As far as the collegiate experience is concerned within the college, as far as how do they make sure that their tuition money is as worth it as possible, make sure that they know what their tuition money or what their tuition dollars pay for. Do you have free access to the athletic facilities on campus? Can you work out? Are you able to tour nature centers? Are you able to get discounts at local establishments because you're a student? The more access that students have to this sort of information, the more likely they're going to go do something about it. Yep. I remember back in the day, the Bohm Theater had a special where you could, if you show your Albion College student ID, I think it was $5, you could get a movie ticket and popcorn and a fountain drink or something along those lines. Those were the glory days, man. That was great.
Nice. So using that as a sort of like benchmark, because I like that a lot, and I think sometimes just educating on what the money goes to is big. We can take that and actually use a lot of that in Phi Mu Alpha. Like just telling people, this is what we spend the money on, even if it's going over the budget with the chapter and saying, okay, this is what all of your money is going to, and this amount goes towards this thing, this amount goes towards this thing. I remember we were in the process of trying to increase dues. But I was doing so as a way to give us a sum of money in our bank account that would allow the chapter to fund members going and doing things with other organizations. We called it our collaboration fund. It was a chunk of money that if, say, the brothers wanted to go to play in this volleyball tournament that this sorority was putting on, or go participate in this thing, and they all require money, they can get it out of that collaboration fund. And obviously, if I would have just put on the budget, this is the new thing, and this is the increased dues, they would have lost their minds because we're increasing dues. But after explaining it to them and explaining this is what it's for, this is what I want it to be used for, they got behind it. And they really wound up being a productive thing that we were able to use out of our budget because people knew about it. And they were aware of it and they were able to take advantage of it in that fashion. Brother Courtright.
What you're talking about is something that in my world we call inoculation, where you're inoculating somebody against what the objection might be. And I love the idea of showing that value there and saying, you know, this is what it's for, because nobody really ever objects to spending money if they feel like they're getting their value out of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I want to make sure we do take some time and touch on some social justice-y stuff. And I am going to preface this again with that if at any point anybody wants to say something, feel free to just pop in. But I wanted to make sure almost that Phi Mu Alpha was doing what they need to do in regards to social justice. And again, this is not saying that the national fraternity or that the locals or any part of the fraternity does badly on it. But I don't remember where this quote is from, unfortunately, but I think to this idea of being an anti-racist, where it's not enough just to not be racist, if that makes sense. And again, this is not me saying that anybody in the fraternity is or that there are issues, or it's me just setting some groundwork here. But it is not enough just not to do the bad things. We also need to help build up people who have been marginalized. And I say who have been marginalized because I think there are some people who might be from a less racially diverse area and think that social justice isn't as important. That's not the case. You know, I don't remember if this is still the number statistically, but Phi Mu Alpha nationally is like, was at one point 40% LGBT identifying. And I don't know, that might have increased since then. It might have decreased, I don't know. But no matter where you are in Phi Mu Alpha, you will find people who are of a marginalized identity. And actively helping those people, whether that is providing them the opportunity. Remind me, I don't remember, because I believe at the 2015, maybe 2018, NatCon, there was the item on the agenda regarding trans men and joining. Was that passed or was that not? I don't remember.
At the 2018 National Convention, there was something to add specific words to our national constitution and bylaws. I believe the phrase was in the anti-discrimination clause portion of the national constitution, was to, the statement itself is something along the lines of, Phi Mu Alpha Sinfonia does not discriminate against anyone, regardless of, and then, you know, laundry list of things. I believe the exact words to be added were gender assigned at birth. That clause was not added to the national constitution. Okay. However, there was a statement that had been released regarding essentially what is our position on it, which is that as long as people can identify consistently and in good faith as male, they are welcome to join our organization.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification because I did not recall where it was and I didn't want to misspeak. But a perfect example of how we can advocate for marginalized people in helping bring them into the organization, give them these opportunities. And I apologize, this has not necessarily been the most eloquent of social justice talks. I promise I'm usually better at these, but the idea for me, and I want to tie this back to the founding of higher education, is a lot of marginalization and discrimination and systemic discrimination comes down to access. The early institutions were made for rich white men to go to school, to become richer white men so that their sons can go to school. And that continued and continued. Due to the lack of access is where a lot of systemic discrimination comes in. And my goal in higher education, and even in Phi Alpha whenever I'm working on anything, is to aid in that access, to help provide the opportunity for people to be brought into a sphere that they might not have been able to bring into, been able to have been brought into. And I appreciate where Brother Courtright brought into the chat, the role of HBCU chapters within Sinfonia, because they're, it is very, I tell when I'm talking at to other people in FSL who aren't related in Phi Mu Alpha, I sometimes bring into the fact that my fraternity is very different in that we have chapters who act more like a Divine Nine chapter, which if you're not familiar, Divine Nine is the National Panhellenic Council, which is nine of the traditionally Black fraternities and sororities. And we have chapters who act more like their IFC chapters, which while not obviously being just white, they are primarily white chapters. And so it's interesting to see that difference. And so knowing that we have so many different chapters and that we have CPRs who might have to go on one day to a chapter from that is primarily white to then go the next day to a chapter that's an HBCU, how can we best support them across the board? I don't really know if I've asked a question in any of that or if I've just kind of rambled, but if anybody wants to add anything or think there was a question in there that they want to answer, go for it.
Real quick, wanted to say thank you to Colin for posting that in the chat. It does contain the wordage that I had used, which was identifying consistently and in good faith as male. I've also put a link to the Divine Nine website for anybody who's interested in checking that out and getting some more information.
And to answer Brother Hoffman's question, yes, Youngstown is closer to PA. It's basically like the border of Ohio and Pennsylvania. I'm not sure exactly where the Western West Virginia part came in. I don't know. But yes, Youngstown is basically right on the border of PA and Ohio.
So I do have a question about the transgender portion. Yeah. How do we deal with non-binary?
So that is a great question. And I'm going to be honest when I start this off with, I am still learning with regards to gender identity. And I've come a long way, but there was a time where much like a lot of other people, the idea of using a they pronoun would be difficult. So this is said with the knowledge on, I'm not necessarily the expert on this, but that I just kind of have some knowledge on it. I know, I'm gonna be honest, I know a lot of brothers, most of them alumni at this point, who are trans women or are non-binary, who consider themselves, use a they pronoun. And my thought on it, from a looking at the membership, looking at the words that are said in the policy written, from this standpoint, if they joined the fraternity and at that time were male identifying and have since either realized their true gender identity or have become comfortable expressing that, I personally think that that is okay. I don't see that as a like they need to be booted or anything. Much like the female symphonians from the 70s and 80s, we would never consider them because they're a woman, they now can't be symphonians. We would never consider that.
Eric, could I speak to this a bit?
Yes, please.
So if somebody is not a symphonian currently and identifies as non-binary, they would not be eligible for membership according to the current wording. The current wording does say that they have to identify consistently and in good faith as male. Non-binary is not male in the sense that it is neither male nor female. However, once they have joined our organization, it is once, always, long live. They are a symphonian for the rest of their life, regardless of how, regardless of if they discover themselves to be something other than they identified as when they joined the organization. This is simply eligibility for membership. It's not continuation of membership.
You said that much more eloquently than I would have, so thank you. Because I was getting there, I just was not saying it well.
The local chapter here has a brother that is by biology male and is non-binary. I don't know when they decided that they were non-binary. I don't know if it happened before the process, during the process, or after. The way that I get around this myself is at the moment where they took the vow, they were male. That's all I care about. And if anybody above me in the fraternity says, well, they fulfill one of the requirements. They have the biological necessity to be male. And I don't know when they decided to not accept a gender as their own. And it's not my decision or my business when they did that. They're in now. They're good people. Leave them alone.
And I like a lot of what you said there. And I want to expand on that because I appreciate the, you know, it's not my business. And it actually is an interesting thing that when you're talking about an invisible identity such as that, because there's, I'm going to try and cliff notes this as best I can. When we're talking about constructed social identities, you have things like race, gender, sexuality, religion, these important things that make up who we are. Some of them are visible. A lot of times you can visibly tell somebody's gender. Sometimes it's not 100% clear, but you can generally tell. You can tell a lot of times people's race. Same thing, not always 100% clear, but for the most part, you can tell. You can almost never tell unless they explicitly tell you somebody's sexual orientation, gender identity, because it's internalized. It's things that we don't necessarily put out there on a silver platter. Similarly, sometimes there might be visual characteristics, but those aren't always a good thing because those stereotypes exist. So you might look at somebody who talks with a certain tone and think they might be of a certain identity, but you could just be flat wrong because it is just a social construct and it is just what society has said are these things. And you know, it gets very, when we're talking about it in regards to bringing somebody into the chapter, it can be very difficult when you're wanting to make sure somebody who identifies as male, but that person might not even know that they don't identify as male yet. And so I appreciate the statements of once they're in, and go forth.
So into the chat just now, I put a link to something referred to as the genderbread person. Anybody who's not seen this resource before, this helped explain a lot of things to me the very first time that I saw it. It helps distinguish among biological sex, gender, gender identity, homosexuality versus heterosexuality versus ace, pan, bi, take your pick. Just about all of these things can exist on a spectrum. It's not ones and zeros. It's all real numbers between one and zero. So please feel free to check out this resource. And anybody who is struggling to understand, please feel free to share this with them as a resource as well.
BGSU has a similar thing that they use, but they actually do it on a penguin instead of a gingerbread person. So, or a genderbread person, yeah.
There you go.
I guess I kind of wanted to, maybe we'll end this with just a story, and this will be my own story. If you feel a need to share it to help make a point at some point in the future, you have that permission. Just don't use my name. You can tell the bits of the story. But maybe some of why I wanted to talk about this tonight a little bit. And I'm gonna be transparent, I don't talk about this often, so it's still kind of raw, even though it happened 8 years ago, no, 9 years ago. But it's thinking about how can Find Mu Alpha help with social justice. And for me, 2011, somewhere in there, I was going through my own process of understanding my sexual orientation. And it's a process. It is not this is what it is. And I wound up actually getting outed by one of the brothers in my chapter. And it was a really hard experience. And it was not so pleasant to then find out that months after that people were talking about it behind my back. And it was big frustrations in that moment. And that is not that in Phi Mu Alpha, that is going to happen frequently. It's natural in our organization. I guess it's mostly a plea to not make it a scene, not make a big deal out of things like that. And obviously don't out somebody if you find out, because it's not a good experience and it's not fun to deal with. So. Any other closing thoughts from anybody?
Actually, to piggyback off of you, Eric, last night after the ritual discussion, we went to Taco Mac, some of us, and we got on this, how in the hell we got there, I don't know. But it's basically, my stance is, until you tell me different, you're straight. I don't care. If you tell me different, and you don't tell anybody else, then cool, I find out, and I don't care. I found one brother on Grindr, and it's like, okay, cool. Nobody else needs to know, because it's their business. So,
yeah.
If you have a piece of information about someone that they don't talk about to other people, then don't. It's pretty simple.
Yes.
And I'm off my soapbox again.
I'll probably never be off of mine. I'm going to spend a lifetime standing on my soapbox. Well, it is 8:01. Do we have... I forget who was going after.
Brother Ponder is up next. And unfortunately, he is going to be unable to present tonight. The storms in his area have knocked out his internet. He literally just sent me a message over Facebook Messenger. As a result, we could potentially keep this conversation going for a little while. But before we make decisions of that nature, I definitely want to say thank you, Brother Juskew, for presenting tonight. We really appreciate your contributions today.
Thank you.
Lots of great information in there and lots of things to think about, especially for the future.
I'm just going to put my email in the chat for anybody who does not have it. Especially for those of you who are currently collegiate members or working in some capacity as a CPR or as a chapter officer, or whatever. If you need help with anything or you have any questions on anything, reach out, let me know. That's kind of what I do. So I'm able to help you out with what I need, with whatever you need. So.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for your presentation tonight, Brother Angel. You can go ahead and stop recording.